And a very good evening to everybody. The program is Off the Wall. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you. And today we're
kind of
interesting place. We're
your bags and
on board an airplane, about ready to take off for the trip overseas to the Chaos Communications Congress. Listen to the announcement. With me today are Redbird.
Good evening.
And Jens.
Hello.
Jens, you're traveling to Europe for the first time ever.
Yes, this is my first time out of the country.
So a lot of this show is going to be devoted to your perspective, I guess, your observations, things you've seen and noticed for the first time, as maybe some of our listeners can live vicariously through you.
Oh, dear. Well, I apologize in advance.
Now, we're recording this while we're still on the ground, and we're actually going to switch it off before we take off, because
it's the proper thing to do.
It's the right thing to do, even though there's absolutely nothing in the world that could possibly cause any kind of problem. We're still going to obey the rules, because we believe in obeying the rules, as you well know if you've listened to this program. So basically, this program will be coming to you mostly from the airplane, but also a little bit in Amsterdam, which is our stop before we head over to Germany. Tomorrow night on Off the Hook, we'll be coming to you live from Berlin, from the Chaos Communications Congress, at about 2 in the morning, our time. We'll let you know how things are going over there, and various other things in addition. Redbird, you're giving a talk this time around.
Yes, I am. It's the same talk I gave at the What the Hack conference that was held in the Netherlands last summer. It's on magnetic stripe technology. It covers a lot of the stuff that was published in 2600 magazine a couple months back. And you know, it's an interesting sort of do-it-yourself lecture. It explains the workings of magnetic stripes, how to build your own reader, that kind of stuff. So.
For those who don't know, the Chaos Communications Congress is an annual hacker gathering that takes place in Germany. It's been going on since 1984, which makes it the longest-running hacker conference in the world, as far as I know. So we have made a point of trying to get there every year, for the last few years anyway. And this year, hopefully, it'll be cool. It's supposed to snow, you know.
Oh, did not plan for that.
It's winter time. Why didn't you plan for that? Jens, you've been to a few hacker conferences. Or have you just been to Hope conferences?
I've only been to Hope conferences, actually, yes.
Okay, well, this will be different because, well, they'll be German. But also, you'll just find that the attitude over there is a lot more laid back and relaxed. And I think maybe we'll ask you your views on that next week after you've actually experienced it. But okay. What are you hoping to see and do on this first trip have you been to Canada, out of the country ever?
I've been to Canada, yeah.
Okay, so the first trip out of the continental North America thing that we have here.
Right, yeah. And for what I hear, I may not want to come back, so we'll find out.
Okay, well then, if you don't, I think we can transfer your ticket to somebody else. We'll let you know on these very same airwaves. Okay, so since the airplane's waiting for us to finish before they taxi out, we're going to stop here and pick this up, I guess, somewhere in mid-flight? What do you say? When's a good time to start talking again?
Don't ask me.
Well, I just did.
Well, I don't have a good answer for you.
Well, maybe when the snacks are coming or when the movie's playing?
Yeah, try to cause some chaos.
Okay. Yeah, you know, we want people to, you know, experience the... There are people listening who have never been on an airplane.
What can I say?
I'll tell them what it's like to be on an airplane, if one thing. You know, that's what radio is. You have to bring life to the people that aren't currently living it. That came out wrong. I didn't mean to say it like that, but regardless, let's... get this bird up in the air, and we'll talk to you in a little bit. Well, looks like we made it into the air. We're airborne now. The takeoff went very smoothly. It seemed to go smoothly from my perspective. We're currently... we have this little video thing that'll tell us where we are exactly, except I can't figure out how to use it. But I think we're, already over, like, Scotland or something? Jens, did you see where we were?
We were approaching Bridgeport, We were so many miles away from... We were 17 miles away from New York, last I saw.
Okay, so then it's not quite as far as I was hoping, but... all right, well, we're still pretty far considering, you know, how long we've been in the air, which is only a few minutes. I was just commenting that when I took the boat over the summer, it was something like 2 days before we even cleared Canada. So it takes a lot shorter time when you're flying at high speeds in the sky. We'll be continuing to check in throughout this hour on our flight progress. Redbird is here with me. Actually, you arrived at the airport before I did, but security was pretty easy this time, wasn't it?
It was not nearly as intense as it was all the other times I've flown. It was pretty lax as far as checking the boarding pass and passports and all that. What we did was we did the online check-in before we actually got to the airport. And so all our boarding pass consisted of was an 8.5 by 11 piece of paper, with the boarding pass on it. And it wasn't actually scanned until we got to the gate.
No, I printed out a few copies because I thought maybe I'd lose one. But I could have printed out 600 copies and given to everybody I saw on the way to the airport and had them all come and join me in the gate. And nobody checked they looked at it, but they didn't scan it. So, I mean, okay, fine. You know, if we're going to say that people can't go to the gate unless they have tickets, or are we not going to say that? Just kind of weird. Also, going through security was really, you know, it was. I'm not complaining because I really think it should be like this because you can't like stop certain things from getting through. But you know, they just kind of look the other way on a lot of like, for instance, my tin of mints went through again. This time it was wrapped in cellophane, and nobody even took a second look at it. I don't know if you can scan through the metal. I don't think you really can see what's in there.
I'm not sure exactly what that looks like from an x-ray perspective, but it did seem a little bit more lax, although they still were very insistent on taking off your shoes and jacket and all that.
Well, that's the weird thing. When we walked up, well, you guys came before I did, but when I walked up, the guy said, "We suggest that you take off your shoes." You know, like, it was an option. And I thought, you know, okay, this is hard enough carrying my bags. And you know, I had to take my laptop. For some reason, you have to take your laptop out of the laptop bag and put it into a tray. And, okay, I was going to give them that. I wasn't going to give them my shoes as well. But when I got to the place where you actually walked through, the guy said, "Take your shoes off." And it's like, okay, why didn't you just tell me to take my shoes off at the beginning? Would have saved some time. But apparently they can't tell you to take your shoes off at that early stage. They can only suggest that you take your shoes off and then later tell you to do it.
Right. The way it was phrased when I was going through was, "We ask that you take your shoes and jacket off." And, you know, I took that as a suggestion, which I didn't necessarily want to follow. So I put everything in the x-ray machine. And I actually did put my jacket in there because it was kind of bulky and whatever. I wanted to carry it after that point anyway. It was hot in the airport. And so I walked through the metal detector with my shoes on. And the guy starts saying, "Shoes and jacket, shoes and jacket," in the x-ray machine. I'd already put my jacket in the x-ray machine. But I just proceeded to go through with my shoes on. I think somewhere in the rules it says that you don't have to take off your shoes. It's a suggestion, but I'm not entirely sure about that.
Well, that suggestion came in the form of a command.
Oh, later it did, and I didn't respond to him, and he started saying it in Spanish.
Why didn't you respond to him?
He made it seem like it was an announcement to the whole crowd, so I just kind of...
And you thought you were exempt from that announcement?
No, I was already kind of through the metal detector. So he made me go back and take off my shoes, and I still wasn't responding to him. And he said, "Shoes for 400, those things on your feet, put them in the x-ray machine." And I was just, it was amusing.
The wit and wisdom of the TSA.
Well, you know, it was amusing, so I got a laugh out of it.
Well, that's a bit of fun, but no, it went pretty smoothly, and, you know, here we are, airborne, not, you know, complaining. I didn't even set off the thing in the metal detector this time. I always do. It always beeps about something, whether it's your belt buckle or your fillings or change or something like that. This time, just sailed right through. I was amazed. I arrived, like, you know, an hour before my international flight, and it was a breeze.
It was very easy this time. It was good. It was a nice flight.
Now, Jen, so I see that... I see that by the map here, we're just passing over Hartford.
Yes, getting closer to Providence, too. We're a lot further along than we were, but not quite to Scotland yet.
No, but we will be there at some point. And here's a bigger map. I see Gander. I see Godthab. If there are any listeners in Godthab, we'd sure like to hear from you. If you don't know where Godthab is, look it up, all right? Because was that Chad I saw?
I don't know. It looked like God, G-H-A-T. It was somewhere
C-H-A-D. Well, no, for some reason Africa showed up on that map. And yeah, I saw Chad. Wow, that's something. So we're making good progress here. We're going to come back in a little while, read some listener mail. Not mail that we've gotten during this show because, well, we're not quite at that stage yet. But we will keep you apprised as we make our way across the Atlantic Ocean. We're taping this actually on the 24th of December. And if you ever want a really good price on an airplane ticket, that's the day to go when no one else wants to travel. That day and I think New Year's Eve.
We got the best price by coming back on the 5th, actually. New Year's Eve wasn't so great.
It wasn't as good as the 5th. For some reason, the 5th was a lower price. But considering we want to spend New Year's Eve in Amsterdam, would have sort of thwarted our plans, you know?
Oh, yeah, it's definitely worth spending New Year's Eve in Amsterdam. That's for sure.
And hopefully next week we'll be able to broadcast that, what it actually sounds like. I know we've broadcast parts of it on Off the Hook over the telephone, but this way we'll have a microphone inside a crowd. And I wouldn't want to bet I'll get in trouble for having a microphone inside the crowd at New Year's in Amsterdam when everything else is happening inside that crowd. It's just, we have a history with this microphone. This year I got in trouble in London. I got in trouble in Moscow. I almost got in trouble in Beijing. But I get in trouble in Tokyo. I think I got in trouble in Tokyo, but not for the microphone. But let's see what happens next week. All right. I'm going to check into the beverage situation here because I haven't eaten anything at all today. Oh, look at that. The outside air temperature is minus 44 degrees Celsius. It's pretty nippy out there.
It's very cold. Yeah, I wouldn't want to go out there.
I don't know if anybody actually does go out there at this altitude. And in the time that we're talking, we've apparently crossed over into Massachusetts. I don't think that map's very accurate. We can't be moving that fast. But we'll be back in just a little while with some more progress reports as we continue our trek overseas on Off the Wall. We're cruising at about, 31,000 feet or something. I think we're clearing Canada now. We're about to start heading over the Atlantic Ocean. We've had our food already, and Jones, you thought the food was pretty good, right?
Yeah, I was actually impressed. I've heard horror stories, but it was good. I liked it.
Well, hopefully those words won't come back to haunt you, but it wasn't bad. Redbird, you were watching that episode of House on the video. Can you tear yourself away for a second?
I'm here.
What's that woman? Is she dying? Is that the deal?
I you know what?
Tell us what's going on in this episode.
I haven't been following it that closely.
You were looking intently into the video screen here. I don't understand. Is the guy's name House? Is that the deal of the show?
I think his name is House, and I think this nun is...
Why does he have such a stupid name? Dr. House? That's his name?
It seems silly.
No, it is silly. It doesn't seem silly. It is.
I have no explanation, though.
All right. Well, speaking of TV, I told you this, Jules, but I came up with a great episode of Lost. I guess it just came to me here on the airplane. But how about an episode where you see it from the perspective of the people who are waiting for them to arrive and realize that they're not going to arrive, and then you sort of go into the lives of those people and, you know, the relatives and friends of all the folks who are trapped on the island someplace. And for those of you who have never seen the program, you have no idea what I'm talking about, but you can sort of figure it out. It's a good program, actually. You're one of the people that turned me onto it.
Oh, yeah. I actually really like it, and I realize just now that they'll probably never show that on an airplane TV system.
Well, they wouldn't really show that kind of episodic television anyway, because you'd have to stay on the airplane for about 2 days to really get the full story.
Well, I suppose. I mean, we've got House, we've got CSI, we've got lots of things to watch, so it's an interesting time.
But you don't have Twin Peaks.
No, not Twin Peaks. That's a good point.
I don't think that's ever been shown on an airplane. So, as I mentioned, we did just have dinner, and it wasn't bad. Actually, I still have two pieces of cake here. I have two because, well, Redbird, you're vegan, and I thought that the cake might have something in it that you couldn't eat, so I grabbed it from you. And you put up quite a fight, in fact, but for your own good, I'm going to keep this for myself. And but you are actually able to find vegetarian food here.
I really lucked out because on all of the other flights I've been on, I was able to request a vegan meal on the same day of the flight. And this time they weren't having it. The excuse was that the computer would not let her request a vegan meal at this point.
Why didn't you request it earlier?
Well, I never had to do that before.
Usually we request, special things, like, well beforehand. Yeah, well, not the day before.
I realize that now. However, all of the other times I've been able to do it the same day. And it was never a problem. Maybe on other airlines they do things differently.
So you learned a lesson.
I learned a lesson.
Hi. Do you have anything to give the stewardess?
Okay. No, I don't.
Can you call them stewardesses? Is that
she tried to steal my soda.
Well, they always want you to give them things as they're walking by. But is the proper term flight attendant or stewardess?
Flight attendant.
Okay. So
you're more politically correct than me, and you don't know this.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I'm ignorant, too.
Okay.
Okay, I also wanted to comment on the pretzels they gave us. Look at these little tiny pretzels.
They're mini pretzels.
These are the smallest pretzels I've ever seen. They used to give you peanuts, but apparently the peanut allergy lobby is so strong that you can't even hand out peanuts on airplanes anymore because the mere odor of peanuts is enough to drive people with peanut allergies crazy.
So now what they do is they give you peanut-sized pretzels.
Peanut-sized pretzels.
It would surprise me if these were made on equipment that also processes peanuts.
Well, by saying that, you're really going to start a panic.
Oh.
That's something to consider. But this pretzel is literally about the size of my fingertip. And I didn't think that they could get this tiny. They're very cute, but you wolf these down in about 3 seconds, and then they're gone, and you're waiting for the next thing to show up. And then there are the napkins. It says on the napkin here, it says, "Work hard, fly right." Now, is that like a command to us? Or I don't understand what they're saying here. Who's supposed to work hard? Are they saying they work hard? Well, then why don't they say, "We work hard, we fly right." Instead it says, "Work hard, fly right."
Sounds like a command to me.
Sounds like a conditional to me.
A conditional? What do you mean?
If you work hard, you can fly right.
So the only people on this airplane are people who have worked hard to enjoy that privilege?
You're on the plane, so maybe that doesn't work. But
I didn't work hard at all, right. Exactly. I just completely, slashed my way onto this thing. Well, I don't know. And, of course, you can probably figure out. We're not going to tell you what airline we're on. We can probably figure out by that slogan which airline we're actually on at the moment. Now, okay, Redbird, you noticed something interesting, too. What you were jabbing me with something.
I was jabbing you with a fork.
You were jabbing me with a fork, but
It wouldn't necessarily be a bad thing, but I've never had metal utensils on the on an airplane before.
You've had plastic utensils.
Always plastic.
I guess, the American public has reached a stage of trust. The airlines now trust us to handle implements of, metal implements of sorts.
I believe I can handle it.
We have butter knives now, too.
Butter knives, yes.
But I guess
I think one more step is a steak knife.
Well, I don't know. That's a pretty big step. And, June, you also discovered something, which I think is I think the coffee tray is going to come pretty soon. Then I can have my two pieces of cake with a nice cup of coffee here. I got to tell you, I am so cramped in here. I've never been in this seat in my life. To give you an idea here, I'm in the middle of the airplane. Jones is to my left, Redbird is to my right.
And we're both really skinny.
Yeah, and we're in the middle of the airplane.
Could you imagine if it was... Never mind.
Yeah, well, it could be a lot worse, I guess. But I don't usually sit in this part of the airplane. I usually sit by the window, or I have the aisle seat next to the window. But, it basically goes 2-3-2. And I'm in the middle of the three. So, first of all, you can get two meals this way. Because someone comes on your left, and if you can hide the tray... All right, it's hard. With all the space you have, it's not much, but you can do it. You can get a second meal by asking the person on the right when they come by. As long as they don't come by at the same time, you'll be okay. Okay, so, Jules, you discovered something. Tell us what you discovered.
Well, apparently...
And you don't know this yet, Redbird, so listen carefully.
I'm flipping through the help manuals. I always like to read the manual, so...
Manual of what, the airplane?
Yes. Well, whatever, Nobody reads manuals anymore. You find some interesting things in them. And in this time... I believe we have our phones. There's handsets built into the seats that you can pull out and use as a remote for your television or whatever. But on the other side is a regular telephone that you can use to make phone calls with a credit card or whatever.
You can watch the funds just be depleted from your credit card account because it's like, what, $3 a minute to use that thing?
I don't know. I didn't really pay much attention to the rates, but I'm sure they're outrageous.
I'd be very careful holding that thing because I don't know if even looking at it incurs a charge.
Well, the thing that caught my eye was a free service, and that is seat-to-seat calling. So,
seat-to-seat calling?
Yes. We're going to try this. I believe you and I have already colluded to set up. You have to tell the phone that you want to allow other people to call you.
So you can call any seat on the airplane as long as they've turned their phone on. And what you have to do is you have to plug in our row number.
Yeah, I hit function one. I'm going to dial in your row number, and I'll dial in your seat number.
But my seat is a letter, though.
Yeah, well, it's the same way you would send an SMS message. You hit the numbers that correspond to that letter.
But aren't those the same numbers? Like, we're D, E, and F. Don't those show up on the same number on the touchtone?
Well, they do, but... For example, the 3 is D-E-N-F, so it's very convenient. So I can hit 3 twice, and that'll give me the E.
I'm a little confused here. Hold on. We're in row, what, 40?
40, yes.
And I'm seat E.
Right.
So you would dial 403 for me, right?
I would dial 40, in this case, 33, because E is the second letter on the 3 key.
Oh, I didn't know that, 33. Yes. And for you dial 32, and for Redbird, 34.
No. It's the number of times you hit the key. So if I hit the 3 once, it's a D. If I hit it twice, it's an E. And the third time, it'd be an F.
So Red Bird would be 333.
Right.
I understand now. Okay, now let's see if my phone actually rings when you do this.
All right.
We'll just hold the microphone up to the phone. It isn't very fast, I gotta say that. You're sitting right next to me, and you're dialing more numbers than calling Belgium or something.
I don't know, it just shut off.
It's shut off. Maybe the circuits are all busy. Well, you know, I'd have to hear the phone ringing. I guess I could look at it to see if it's ringing, but that sort of defeats the purpose.
I think you're supposed to hear it ringing, and it'll actually tell you what seat is calling you.
So it's sort of caller ID.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
Are you sure you're doing this right?
I'm following the directions, whether or not they...
Are you sure you're doing this right?
Again, I'm following the directions.
So you're dialing 4033.
Function 1, 40...
Function 1 first. Just to be safe, I'm going to hold my phone. It's also a pain in the ass to get out of the seat.
You can see I've dialed.
All right.
I've dialed your row number, and it's displayed on the thing. And if I hit send...
You hit send, and absolutely nothing is happening. Maybe I have to turn my phone on again?
I don't know.
I'll hit the on button. And nothing's happening there either.
I think you have to hold
it. Is this... high technology. It says slide card. I am not going to fall for that.
Try function 2 again. See if
function 2?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, this isn't exactly intuitive. Well, just a little 2 appeared on the screen when I did that. How do I clear that? I'll hit function again and hit another 2. Now there are 2 2s on the screen. No, this isn't working out very well. I think we need to experiment with this some more. Well, okay. I guess... This just shows you. I don't know how many people actually make phone calls from seat to seat on the airplane, but you know, we could hack the plane and call every single seat and see who has their phone turned on, and really annoy the people in first class. Wow, this could be a lot of fun. But they'd know where you're calling from. They could come back and cause grief for you.
Yeah, I haven't found how to block my caller ID.
Well, try *67 before, and we'll see about that. You figure out anything, Redbird?
No, it's not working.
It's not working for you either?
No.
My guess is that it got too annoying for the other passengers and they turned it off.
Well, if that's the case, they should at least tell us so we don't waste all of our time trying to program these things. Okay, who makes these phones? It doesn't say either.
No. Boeing, maybe.
All right. Well, we're passing over the Labrador Sea right now as we fly over Newfoundland. And when we come back, we're going to have some listener mail and some other comments. Maybe we'll get the phones to work by then? What do you think?
Well, we'll try.
We're going to give it our best shot. And, oh, look, the coffee tray is coming. So I have to go for that. We'll talk to you in a bit. We'll be right back. Okay, now, this is... I'm surrounded by two people who are furiously beeping their phones. You know, this is... Whenever you take an airplane ride with hackers, it's always going to be something fun. But Redbird, you actually found something weird as far as asking you for a password or something?
It's very strange, because...
explain exactly what you're hitting to get it to ask for a password.
June's mentioned that function one allowed you to make a phone call to another seat. Function two allowed
you to... Which doesn't work.
Right, well, it doesn't work. Function two allowed you to change whether or not you were willing to accept incoming calls. And so I played around for other functions, and function pound didn't seem to do anything, but it did light up the backlight. And then typing anything afterwards results in a series of asterisks showing up. And then pressing send resulted in password failed. So I went through a couple of possible passwords.
Try 1234?
I tried 1234. After quite a few, I ended up with 00. Hit send, and it said password accepted, but I'm not...
Wait. You got the password?
Yes. It says password accepted. I'm not sure quite what that means yet. And as our listeners could probably guess, 00, not necessarily very secure.
A two-digit password, 00.
Yes.
But we don't know what the password is for.
It says password accepted, but doesn't seem to do
anything. Why don't you try making a phone call? Maybe you can make a phone call for free now.
I tried. It doesn't work.
I gotta say, though, you know, I know I said before that the takeoff was... you know, the part of the flight that filled me with the most trepidation, but really, it's being up in the air like we are now. You know, that's the worst part of the flight for me, because let me think of it. We're 40,000 feet above the ground.
It's pretty intense, you know, but
it's pretty scary. Is I think the right word.
It is scary, but you have to trust, you know, laws of physics and all that allow us to.
Well, the laws of physics are exactly what say this thing shouldn't happen.
No, it should happen. Of course, it should. Otherwise,
humans shouldn't be flying in the air. That's my understanding when I arrived on this Earth.
Well, you're flying in the air.
I realize that, but I shouldn't be. I don't quite know why I'm flying in the air, but...
Who are you to say that?
Well, that's the thing. That's why this is the most nerve-wracking part right now, when I'm in the middle of the sky, which is why I'd like to get back to our listener mail, which fortunately will take me right back down to the ground. Well, maybe not quite in that way, but you know what I mean. Make me think like I'm on the ground. Yeah, and you can write to Off the Wall by sending email to otw@2600.com. That's otw@2600.com. It's Manuel Goldstein. I'm here with Junts. I'm here with Redbird. We're on an airplane heading to Amsterdam from Newark International Airport. The duty-free shop has just passed by. I guess they want us to spend our last remaining dollars on something. You've never seen that before, have you, Junts?
What's that?
Duty-free shop passing by in the aisle.
Not on the plane. I can't imagine spending money on the plane for things like that.
You know, I got to be honest. I've never quite gotten the concept of duty-free. You know, I mean, what is it you're actually saving? You're saving some kind of tariff or tax?
You're saving the duty.
Yeah, but, you know, if you bought it back home, you wouldn't be paying a duty, would you?
I suppose not. I don't really know.
Who buys things? I mean, nobody on this airplane seems to have bought anything. So I don't know what that's all about. And the things that you get, too, they're kind of worthless, aren't they?
I would imagine. Yeah, they've got,
Let's see what they have here. They have Benson & Hedges, Marlboro. Oh, that looks like just cigarettes.
Cigarettes on an unsmoking plate.
Well, yeah, what are you supposed to do with the cigarettes? You can't smoke them here. And smoking is very bad for you.
Yes.
All right. Let's look at some of the pieces of mail that we've gotten in the last couple of weeks. Dear Manuel, having... just listened to your podcast from December 6th. I have to say, hearing those comments from an American really makes my day. It's so very good to know there are people in the U.S. who really get it and understand that what we, U.S. and U.K., have done is to depart from the moral high ground we once held. How can we comment on the actions of others when we invade other countries without backing from the rest of the world or even consensus in our own countries? I would argue that this should never happen, but at least if we had backing, we could claim some justification. I watched the pictures of the Iraq invasion with tears in my eyes, and I still get upset when I see the daily bombings in the news. We have brought a deep shame upon ourselves. Bush and Blair are war criminals, but this isn't the saddest thing. The saddest thing is that the world and we have done nothing to stop them. They are still in power. The protesters have given up. Their demonstrations ignored. When will we see Blair and Bush in The Hague? Signed, Mark. Well, Mark, thanks very much for that letter. And Mark writes to us from Scotland. Well, I'd sure like to see Bush in The Hague. Maybe if we can, fool him like they do with those You know, occasionally there are these criminals who owe money, you know, for not paying child support or, you know, some kind of fraud or something like that, and they're invited to some big party or something, and then the feds swoop in on them and arrest them all because they're stupid enough to actually show up. Maybe we can get Bush, you know, to go to The Hague to accept some kind of an award. And then, you know, the international forces or whatever can surround the place and, you know, have them answer a few questions without help. Well, I'd like to see that. I really would. And I'm in international waters now, so I think I can say that without risk of being labeled a traitor. Let's try this one. You mentioned that New York City's public transit with the strike was better off than Detroit. I just wanted to let you know that I don't think comparing it to Detroit makes New York City look any better. A third world country with only donkeys pulling wagons as transport is better than what Detroit has to offer. We have the worst public transportation for a major city in the U.S., which shouldn't even be considered public transportation, seeing as the buses aren't safe or on time. The people mover is a one-way moving joke, and getting a cab is harder than finding a hooker in the suburbs. As you can see, I'm very thankful for all that Ford, GM, and Chrysler have done for Detroit public transportation. Signed, Bug Dave. And P.S., I look forward to getting angry every week with our governments, among other things. Thank you. Well, I'm happy to help people get angry every week. And speaking of getting angry, we just had a transportation strike here in New York City. And, I guess I was the only person who really had a lot of fun with that. Redbird, you didn't have too much fun, did you? You were kind of angry about the whole thing.
I was upset about it, but I didn't have all that much of a hassle getting into the city. I was coming from Hoboken, and so I was able to take the path with no problem. It was running on schedule, and they didn't seem to have too much of an issue with overcrowding and whatnot, except when they were offering the service from World Trade Center to 33rd Street. But everything from Jersey to New York was running smoothly.
It was a hassle. I mean, you know, I had to deal with the idiocy of them not letting my smart car in, which was a two-seater, because it didn't have four people in it. You know, the car is half the size. I thought that might actually, you know, be appreciated, but it wasn't. And plus the fact that I was there an hour early, but that wasn't good enough, apparently, because there was a major rush hour in the middle of the night, thanks to the city's ill-conceived plans. But, you know, I looked at it with humor. I think a lot of people were just sort of, you know, hunkering down and somehow getting through it. This is what makes New Yorkers tough people, because, you know, we experience things like blackouts and strikes occasionally, and we get through it. And I think that's the important lesson to learn here, is that, okay, it's a hardship, but this doesn't have to cripple us. It's something that we can get through if we simply use our ingenuity a bit. The strike's over. It lasted 3 days. But I really, you know, I take great exception to people who say that they had no right to go out on strike. How can we say anybody has no right to go out on strike? Yeah, they're not forced to have this job, but does that mean they're forced to accept conditions that, quite frankly, are unacceptable? You can always find somebody who will accept a job for a minimum wage or less, slave labor. You can always find people like that in some part of the world. Does that make it fair to say that, yes, someone will fill your shoes? I think when people think they're being treated unfairly, no matter who they are, they should be able to do that.
I'm not really in such a great position to argue this, but I do believe that by them going on strike, it really put a lot of people who had to get to their jobs at jeopardy of losing their jobs. And in a lot of cases, I know employers were threatening to fire those who could not show up to work and stuff like that. It's a very important season for people to be able to get to work. I know someone who owns a shop downtown in New York, and he lost a whole lot of business because of the strike, and it's not fair to everyone else. I mean, everybody has hardships in their jobs and whatnot, but you know, when you're capable of shutting down the entire city for the most part, you know, it's not fair to do it. It's not fair for everyone else who has to get to work and who has to, you know, endure tough jobs and whatnot. I mean, everybody has to. You know, there are other ways of bargaining.
I mean, I don't think it's about fairness though. When you're concerned about how you're being treated, you can't think of how everybody else is going to be affected by you complaining about that or taking action against that. You know, I'm suing the city right now because of what happened during the Republican National Convention. Maybe that will inconvenience somebody. Maybe, you know, because the city will lose that lawsuit, and they will, that somehow, you know, something will be taken out of something else and somebody won't benefit. You know, I just think it's a never-ending cycle if you start thinking about how my actions are going to inconvenience somebody. What you really should focus on is, are you being treated fairly? Are the people around me being treated fairly? And I think that's the purpose of a union. What good is a union if it can't call a strike? I just don't follow the logic. There is no position that I can think of where a strike wouldn't cause inconvenience. And yes, it's unfortunate that it happened this time of year, but whose idea was it for a contract to end right before Christmas? You know, I think that was ill-conceived to start with. That could have easily been prevented.
Well, I really don't know all of the details, but there are other ways to negotiate a contract, and I mean, that's really what the Taylor Law was intended to do, right? You know, arbitration and all that sort of thing for the, you know, with contracts.
But it didn't work. It didn't work. And, the whole Taylor Law thing, I don't get the logic of it. I mean, I get the logic from the people that want to prevent other people from going out on strike. But to say that they had absolutely no right to do this, well, what were they supposed to do? If they felt they weren't getting a fair deal, what, just all quit?
Well, okay, so you're looking at it from the point of view of the transit workers, but now look at it from the point of view of every other New Yorker who had to get to work, had to commute, and wasn't able to do so, or had to walk 6 miles to get to work, or, you know, like, it's not, you know, you could look at it from whoever's point of view you want, and maybe it's not fair to the transit workers, and maybe it's not fair to you know, those who had to commute, but, you know, it's...
Okay, well, can you name somebody that you think should have the right to go out on strike?
No, I don't want to get into that.
Well, I mean, you know, are you saying no one should have the right to go out on strike? Because there is not a single job I can think of where going out on strike would not inconvenience somebody else.
No, I don't have a specific example of this.
I just think if you start, you know, targeting certain people, be they cops, teachers, transit workers, and say, you're not allowed to go out on strike, you're just kind of taking something away from them, a fundamental right. Now, we're on our way over to Europe right now. Everybody's always going out on strike over there for various reasons. Sometimes it's chaos, pandemonium, you know, air traffic controllers are always going out on strike. In our country, back in the States, our reaction was to fire them all, which, you know, to this day I have a big problem with, and that was done a long, long time ago under Reagan. But I think it set a bad precedent, because now workers don't really have that leverage, or they know that they can lose a lot by making a stand. Now, I'm not saying, you know, unions aren't corrupt. They are, of course. There's all kinds of corruption going on. But I just think we needed to be a little bit more sympathetic, and I don't think they were out to screw the riding public. I think they were out to make a statement, and I'm glad they went back. And they did go back without a contract.
Well, I mean, if you look at it from the point of view of, what was it, the FAA who fired all the traffic controllers?
It was Reagan, really.
Okay, well, whatever. I mean, you know, it worked for them. It, you know, you don't show up to work. You're going to disable our... You know, you're going to disable basically all of the air traffic in what was in the whole United States, right?
Yeah, the United States. You know, it certainly did send the message, if every air traffic controller felt they were being treated unfairly, that we better look at this. We better do something about this. If every doctor feels that, you know, if doctors are unionized, if they felt that they were being treated unfairly and they all walked out, well, you know, we'd want to deal with that. We want to make sure that they thought they were being treated fairly. Same thing with teachers. Same thing with cops. You know... Basically, if people are unhappy or unsatisfied in their position and they speak out about it, you want to take that seriously. Now, people are always complaining, but, you know, sometimes
I mean, that's the thing. People are always complaining, and where do you draw the line between something that really needs enough attention to shut down one of the largest cities in the country versus something, you know, that they're just, you know, whining about?
Well, the point is...
I'm not using this specific example as, you know... necessarily something that they didn't have the right to whine about, because like I said I don't know all the details,
but if they don't go on strike, then it's just complaining, and you say, okay, they're just complaining, that's all they do, and you don't take it seriously. That's the problem.
Well, like I said, everybody has a job that they complain about. Everybody always wants more. You're really putting other people at risk as well when you go on strike and allow them not to be able to get to work.
I think everyone has to figure out a way to be a little bit more sufficient and not rely on anything. If your car runs out of gas, you got to figure out a way to, you know, to get to where you're going. If there's a blackout, you have to figure out a way to get downstairs. If the trains aren't running, and I think for the most part, New Yorkers did quite well, and I think we're stronger for that. Now, what I do think is extremely unfair is what you mentioned before, employers firing people for being late or not showing up because of the transit strike. And that kind of thing should not be permitted. There should be all kinds of oversight as far as that goes to make sure no one's treated unfairly as a result of not being able to get someplace.
Well, there's nothing really you can do about that if you have private employers saying that, okay, if you know, there's nothing really that you can do.
Oh, yes, there is, of course. You tell me what private employer is doing that, and, you know, let's spread some publicity about it. And maybe we boycott their stores or businesses or whatever. You just let people know these people are bastards. They're treating their employees unfairly.
Well, I don't necessarily think that's going to happen. But, you know, businesses were losing millions and millions of dollars every day because of the transit strike. And I don't think it's fair for, you know, for you to cause that much damage to make your point. I just don't think it's
okay,
fair.
But you're saying they caused the damage. But is not the MTA as culpable because they didn't reach an agreement and they didn't take it seriously?
No, I'm not saying I'm not defending the MTA, and I'm certainly not defending the TWU, but I'm just saying, you know, there's cause and effects to everything, and, you know, the TWU and the MTA, I guess, you know, under certain circumstances, had the ability to not go on strike or to not have the TWU go on strike, and I don't know. I just think it's unfair to the rest of the public, and that these two groups need to find another way of settling their arguments then.
Well, I mean, the city wasn't even shut down, though. I mean, I was in the city on Wednesday, and, you know, there were a lot of people there. I got to stand in line with a whole lot of nice folks. And
you got a lot of exercise.
I got a lot of exercise. And you know what? That was great. That was great. I walked all the way from the East Village down to Wall Street for the radio show, which is a good hour-long walk. And, you know, I think I might do that every week because I just felt so much better doing it.
Right, but you have to understand that not everybody has the time to do that. I mean, we have a friend who walked, you know, 6 miles to get to work, right? So, you know, some people can do that, but a lot of people can't.
A lot of people can't, but, you know, I think we don't make enough time for things like that. It's true, we work harder than ever before. Everyone is always at the office till 11 o'clock at night. But, you know, at some point you sort of have to say, enough already, I'm going to do this. And I think maybe this got people to think, I can walk across the bridge if I need to. And maybe next time I'll want to. And I just think it's a good thing to try. So maybe, you know, there's some positive things that can come out of the strike. I'm just trying to think of something good that might have come out of it.
Well, I think that, you know, I do agree with the point. However, I think it's much easier said than done. Not everybody, like I said, has the time to do that. Maybe we have the time to do that. And, you know, it was interesting to see how everybody reacted when there was no subway and there was no buses, which is something that you always expect to be around when you're in New York.
I do think, though, that the authorities, mainly the mayor's office and the MTA people, I think they made the situation... Uh-oh. What does that mean, that beep? Because we're experiencing turbulence? Is that what it is?
Apparently the seatbelt light just came on.
Okay. Yeah, while we were arguing there, we were bumping around, too. So I thought it was because I was gesticulating with my hands, but apparently not. Or if it was, I'm sorry. okay, so yeah, we have to stay in our seats now. But I just think they made it so much worse by just stirring up resentment. Instead of hoping for a quick resolution, they were calling the people thugs and saying all kinds of nasty things and just basically imposing these weird restrictions that just built up traffic, made things harder. And, you know, New Yorkers can get through almost anything. And I think this was a good opportunity for us to just sort of help each other out, get through it, and realize that we're stronger than we thought we were. This thing is going to end soon. Let's just grin and bear it. And I think for the most part, that's what people did. And I don't think most people have that much lingering resentment towards the TWU. I hope not. And I hope they get a decent contract so that this kind of thing doesn't happen in the future.
Well, if you want to go back to how, you know, the mayor and whatever handled it, I mean, the restrictions that you're referring to, I guess, are the traffic restrictions. I mean, you know, think about what Manhattan would have been like, you know, during the strike if they hadn't made those restrictions.
Well, again, I still don't see that logic because, well, first of all, Queens and Brooklyn were complete madhouses because of the 4-person-per-vehicle restriction that went into effect at 5 in the morning.
Right, but
starting at 3:30 at night, people were mobbing the streets and not getting across the bridge because there were so many people there. And how many people get in their cars, drive into the city because they can't get a subway ride from Penn Station? It doesn't make sense. If there's no Long Island Railroad, if there's no New Jersey Transit, yeah, okay, then you would drive your car in. That makes more sense. But that wasn't what happened here. So I don't understand what the logic was there. It just seemed to be getting people as inconvenienced as possible, as angry as possible, and serving some kind of purpose.
No, I think it was probably the appropriate thing to do because people who normally commute and are left off wherever the LIRR stops and wherever, you know, Metro North stops and whatever, where all the commuter lines stop, and still have, you know, 60 blocks, 80 blocks, 100 blocks to go to get to work.
Who has 100 blocks to go from 34th Street?
Okay, I'm exaggerating.
But there were these things called taxis, and, you know, a lot of these taxis were left in Queens because they didn't have enough people that they could pick up at 3:30 in the morning to go across the Queensboro Bridge, which took an hour and a half at that time.
Well, there were taxis. The taxis are more expensive, but, you know... than a $2 supper.
I'm just saying, and there are also cases, we talk about people losing income. Do you know those little hot dog carts that people would pull over in their cars so that they could sell things on street corners in New York? They weren't letting those cross the bridge because they didn't have four people in the car.
That's silly, but...
But that's the kind of, like, ridiculousness that everybody was facing.
People are going to act ridiculously in a situation like this, and I don't think people were going to use the logic where, okay, I could take the LIR in, or I could take Metro North in, and just grab a cab. I think they would have probably said, okay, why don't I just drive in? I'll fight the traffic and find a garage.
I don't know anybody who would think that. I mean, a lot of people commute, and I don't think anybody was saying, yeah, you know, traffic is going to be good. I think I'm going to drive in instead of taking the Long Island Railroad and maybe walking or taking a cab. It makes no sense to me. But listen, I'd love to argue about this for the rest of the entire flight, but we only have an hour on this show, and I do have to read at least one more letter before we go to our next segment. And you know, they turned off the lights. You know, they always do that when you take an airplane.
You have this nifty button over
here. But you know, last time I hit that button, I accidentally called the flight attendant.
That button?
I think you turned on someone else's light.
Yeah.
Oh, that's my light. Thank you very much. God, that's blinding. All right. Dear Emmanuel, I really like today's show. Not today's show, because obviously you couldn't have written in about that yet. And I would like to comment on the changes you noticed in the actions of American government, military, and security agencies. News about torture are popping up. The president is lying to Congress about his motives to go to war and promoting a gradual transition towards martial law in the country. But if you think about it, is that all that different from past American policy? The USA has spread torture in Latin America and all around the world for decades, maybe more than a century. Several of the dictatorships you mentioned in Latin America, the Middle East, etc., were in fact founded by the USA through the 20th century. Not only those dictators were funded by American loans, they were trained by American personnel. In Brazil, the Escola Superior de Guerra, and in several other Latin American countries, the Escuela de la America, were a place where American military trained and taught torture techniques to local military and law enforcement. In Brazil, this was created a couple of years before the military takeover in 1964. So has American policy changed very much? Well, yes, there's a difference between it. One hand hiring some third world military to do your torture, and on the other hand doing it yourself and half admitting it in the press. The news from places like Brazil and Guatemala is old, but now they're doubling its capacity this coming year. And even if law enforcement ignores civil rights and human rights laws when it's dealing with a minority and poor population, now the Patriot Act just overrides those laws altogether, and those rights are taken away from everyone. Signed, Chico. Well, Chico, thank you very much for writing to us. It's always good to hear from listeners. And yeah, these are dark days, I guess, but they'll be all the brighter if we keep an eye on it together, I guess. I don't know. What do you think, Redbird? Do you think we're heading towards hell?
No, we're heading towards Amsterdam.
Yeah, I guess that's the way to look at it. What do you think, Jens?
Yeah, I hope so.
Yeah. Well, let's going through a little bit more turbulence. And as I said, this is the most turbulent time of the ride for me, so we're going to take a little break, come back in a moment, then we'll be all closer to our destination at that point. Looks like we've begun our descent into Amsterdam. I gotta tell you, this flight went really, really fast, don't you think, Jens? Of course, you slept through a lot of it.
Well, yeah, that helps to speed it up a little.
Yeah, I never sleep through airplane flights. I got a lot of work to do, and plus I just don't like sleeping when I'm moving. But, you know, that's me. Of course, Redbird over here is still asleep. We're going to have to wake his ass up before the show ends. Uneventful flight, I guess, for the most part. It's interesting, though, because when I took the boat over here, it took 6 days, and it took 6 hours for the airplane. So I think, you know, we've proved beyond any possible doubt that planes are faster. They really are.
Definitely, yeah, you're right. We made about an hour, and each hour on the plane is a day on the boat. That's an amazing amount of time.
Yeah. So they move really slowly. You know, my ears are really bothering me. I gotta reach in and get some of that gum. I I bought gum yesterday because for some reason they don't sell gum in airports anymore. You notice that? I don't know why. Whose idea was it to stop selling gum in airports? Want a piece?
Sure.
It's really good for your ears.
It's good.
Yeah. And a reminder about ready to hang on. There we go.
Thank you.
So explode. Sometimes, you know, when I land, it's really painful. Other times I don't even notice anything. It's the oddest thing. Now, I don't know why we're tired. I mean, I've been tired the whole flight, but for us, it's about 1 o'clock in the morning, and I'm usually, that's my peak period.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know why I'm tired. I don't know how I'm going to feel during the rest of the day, because, of course, where we're going, it's about 7 or 7:30 or something like that now. So my way of doing it is to go through the entire day, and then when it gets to be like 11 o'clock at night, I'm really tired. I fall asleep, then I wake up early the next morning. I think that that kind of works.
But, yeah, I don't know if I would fare so well, so I tried to get a few winks in before we land. So.
I also drank 3 cups of coffee, which is kind of unheard of for me. Anyway, but just before we go, you were experimenting with the phone that's attached to the seat, and I believe you actually managed to get it to say something.
Well, yeah, after we got past the password prompt and then tried to dial one of the seat-to-seat calls, we got an error message on the screen, something about a code 27, nothing that we could tell exactly what was wrong, but it was more information than we were getting before.
Code 27, you say?
I believe that's what it said, yes.
Okay, well, undoubtedly, there are people out there who know just what's going on with these phones, and they can let us know by writing to otw@2600.com and telling us. And,
ladies and gentlemen, just a brief update from the flight deck.
Here it comes.
We're exactly 100 miles from our destination. We're starting our initial descent for landing. The seatbelt sign is on, so if you're moving around the cabin, please return to your seats, fasten your seatbelt, and prepare for our arrival. The weather in Amsterdam is some scattered clouds, excellent visibility, light variable winds. Temperature is 35 degrees Fahrenheit right now. We will be touching down just about on the hour, around 8 o'clock local time, and we'll be at the gate at 8:10 to 8:15. It's usually a long taxi. The airport is very large, and it takes us about 10 minutes to get to the gate. We hope you had a pleasant flight with us.
Well, I guess we did. But I gotta tell you, man, these seats are cramped. You know, there's no room at all to move around. The whole trip, my arms have been basically really tight to my side, and you have to sort of have everything, you know, in a particular place.
The captain has turned on the fasten seatbelt sign. Please check that your seatbelt is securely fastened. To prepare for landing, it will be necessary to collect all service items as well as any other items you wish to discard, such as newspapers.
This is a recording. You know that, right?
Yeah.
They've stopped.
Dames en heren.
Oh, now it's going to be in Dutch.
De gezagvoerder heeft de verlichting.
Well, hopefully we can be heard over this. I got to say, you know, what I said before, the real anxious part for me is this part of the flight, where you're about to land. You know, this is the hardest part, where you're actually coming down onto the ground. Because, you know, most, you know, misfortunes involving airplanes occur when it actually hits the ground. You know, and that's why that's the most you know, sensitive part of the journey. So this is the part where I'm the most nervous. So yeah, hopefully that'll fare okay, and I guess in the next section we'll talk about that. So let's turn off all our electronic devices, and we'll see you in the streets of Amsterdam, hopefully. Well, we made it to Amsterdam. Jens is here, seeing the city for the first time. Jens, what do you think of the place?
Well, I'm impressed, actually. I hear the stories all the time about how Europeans seem much more sensible and laid back than we are at home. And I got to tell you, it's the truth. You get that feeling from everybody right off the bat. And it's been a wonderful feeling for me out here. That and the just looking around, the scenery is beautiful. The buildings are amazing. The trams going everywhere. It's been a really eye-opening experience for me.
Well, it's always good to see the magic be reborn again in someone else's eyes, and this place never loses its magic for me. Every time I come here, it's just so relaxing, you know, seeing how people kind of just get along with each other and deal with life and don't get all stressed out all the time. And hopefully that'll help us when we get back to the States. But for now, we're on our way to Berlin, and tomorrow night on Off the Hook, we'll be doing a special broadcast from there. And we'll be back again next week on Off the Wall with a special New Year's celebration that we will be recording right here in Amsterdam. And that's going to be fascinating because we'll be right there in the middle of all the mayhem, and you'll hear it as if you were there too. So until those two shows come your way, this is Emmanuel Goldstein for Off the Wall. Have a good night.